Welcome to the Scalable Real Estate Investing Podcast, where we discuss the most scalable strategies, tools, and approaches to successfully invest in real estate. Learn how to make the most impact of your time, automate your real estate investing business, find off-market deals with minimum time invested, and leverage your capital to create as many income streams as possible so that you can achieve true financial independence. Thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Mason Clement.
Hi everyone, Mason Clement here. Before we get into today's episode, I wanted to ask you one question. Are you sick of the wild swings in the stock market and ready to try something different? Did you know that investing in stocks actually put you at the very bottom of a company's capital structure, meaning that there's practically 0% chance that you're going to get any of your money back in the event that the company files bankruptcy? That basically you're putting yourself in the riskiest position for a questionable return. Personally, I hate the unpredictability and just waking up and having half of my investment gone when I didn't do anything wrong. So what a lot of people don't know is that you can actually make higher returns on a consistent basis by investing in the opposite end of the capital structure, which is actually the safest place to be, which is on the debt side in a first lien position. And you can do that by investing in real estate and specifically investing with my company in notes that are backed by the land that we purchase. So if you're ready to diversify your income stream, go ahead and go over to scalablereI.com and click on invest in the top right corner. There you're going to find a form that you can fill out to determine if you're eligible to invest with my company, Celion Capital, and we'll be reaching out to you to schedule an introductory call and speak more from there. So thanks a lot, and let's jump into the episode.
Yeah, we don't have to drag it along. Obviously, I just like to have a natural flowing conversation. So we'll see. Probably be like 30, 45 minutes. We'll see how it goes.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. However the conversation is, there's plenty to talk about.
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah. And I noticed that on your website, you'll do a variety of different types of properties. So we'll start with land and then we'll get into commercial real estate, mainly because that's kind of my situation. I'm a full-time land investor, but trying to acquire some commercial real estate as well. Trying to look at hotels right now, but always open to other types of commercial real estate too. So that's kind of the general direction I want to go with it. So, sure. All right, we'll just trim off this last part we just discussed and jump into the quick little intro. Hey everyone, I'm Mason Clement, host of Scalable Real Estate Investing Podcast. And today we have DJ McClure, who is a vice president at National Flood Experts. You can check them out at nationalfloodexperts.com. I thought it'd be really valuable to have them on the show to discuss flood zones and what you can do about them. So that way you're not just passing up another opportunity. I know that I'm guilty of it myself, just looking at something, it's 100-year floodplain or something. And I'm like, I don't know. I don't want to mess with that. So before I try to act like I know what I'm talking about when it comes to that, let's just jump into things and talk with DJ. What's going on?
Hey, Mason, how are you? Glad to be here. Hopefully share some good nuggets information for the audience. And hopefully flood zones maybe next time around won't be an automatic skip for you or some of your audience.
Oh, yeah, definitely. So what I like to do with every guest, in case they're not familiar with you, is just talk about kind of the journey and background and what brought you to today, in your case, working with National Flood Experts.
Yeah, I've always had an interest in real estate. I kind of had unique grooming, I guess, professionally. I was a professional tennis coach for a number of years. And so spent most of my 20s hanging out with young kids and, you know, trying to teach them how to be a successful tennis player. And so I like to think that's a lot of where my, you know, sales and problem solving skills have, really originated. And then moving into the latter part of my career, I met this team and, you know, it was very much the same thing, right? So we're helping, you know, investors all over the country and property owners solve the problem that flood zones create. And so I've been with NFE going on my sixth year. And, you know, it's been an incredible journey for myself as a real estate, you know, investor, and then as a consultant, getting to work with all verticals of real estate all over the country. And so it's been a great journey that we've been on.
Okay. And you said you've been an investor yourself. Like, what kind of real estate have you been purchasing?
Well, naturally, when you work with real estate investors every day, you know, the magnetic pull is very strong. And so myself, looking at multifamily on the passive side, and so a number of projects over the last several years, and, you know, just kind of keeping that on the personal side. So it helps me keep my ear to the ground for opportunities, but, you know, it's been a great education working with so many great investors and getting to learn along the way.
Okay. Yeah, that's really interesting. So I know before we started recording, I mentioned that we'd discuss land investments, which we can definitely get to, but I never considered that, like, from an LP passive investment perspective for a multifamily syndication. How do you kind of vet the deal from like a floodplain, flood zone angle? And how do you look at things when you're vetting them?
Well, yeah, coincidentally, most of my investments are not in flood zones. Not by design, just by, you know, just by coincidence, really. But no, I mean, you know, when you're looking at opportunities that are in flood zones, a lot of times these deals get passed over. And, you know, when there are circumstances to where the buyer can obviously improve the NOI, if there's a way to dramatically reduce the flood insurance cost, it's typically not a strategy that's built into the original underwriting. And so, you know, a typical deal, they might be underwriting, you know, well, what used to be, you know, maybe less than $1,000 a door. Now it's obviously north of that in a lot of areas. The property insurance, the flood, everything kind of gets grouped together. And so whenever there's an opportunity to, for example, get the flood zone changed where the lender requirements for the flood insurance can be removed, that can be a pretty immediate valuation increase. And so a lot of buyers will come to us, you know, at due diligence, we'll do the analysis. And when it's possible, it's a nice bonus appreciation that those investors are realizing from day one.
Okay. And how would they convince the lender to remove that requirement?
Well, you know, convince is really the wrong word, because the way the flood insurance mandates are regulated, it's a federal compliance requirement that all federal loans have to pass on when a property is located inside a 100-year flood zone. And so think about it, like any property you'd buy that's not in a flood zone, there's not a lender requirement for the flood insurance. So whenever you're able to go to FEMA and have a building or an area of the flood map officially changed and removed from the 100-year flood zone, it removes the lender requirement for the flood insurance also. And it's very objective, very black and white. All the federal loan programs, Fannie, Freddie, all in between, they all follow the same protocols.
Okay.
This is the same for land as well.
Right. And to my knowledge, the way you do that, well, first, sorry, I was going to back up. And just for people that aren't familiar with flood zones or flood plains, I mean, you have like your 100-year, these are all set by FEMA, right? The Federal Emergency Management Association, is that what it stands for? I think it stands for.
Agency, yeah.
Agency, yep. And so you'd actually have to go to FEMA with a study saying, hey, I think this is not actually going to flood. But basically, it's like there's like a 2% chance it'll flood within 100 years or 2% chance it'll flood within 500 years, right? Which is like zone X. And then 100 years,
right?
Like
so AE. Outside of the 100 year, you have the X zones, which are considered lower risk. It's kind of an antiquated term, really, to say 100 year or 500 year. But it's a terminology that currently still exists. So yeah, anything inside 100 year, this is where the lending programs feel that, you know, at least by the way the law was created, those are the types of properties that are a higher enough risk that they need to have flood insurance on the loan.
Okay. Is it a 1% chance or 2% chance, or do you never even consider the percent chance?
Yeah, we really don't look at it in terms of a percent chance. And so, yeah, so you look at 100 year versus a 500 year. Well, the 500 years, you know, 0.02, and you know, the 100 year is, you know, a little bit more likely than what that would be. But in reality, what's happening is that the local counties are managing their flood studies all over the country. And as they're updating their flood studies every 10 to 15 years, new flood maps are then kind of all amassed together to form you know, the national flood map once FEMA's done their final review. And so you don't see these maps updated terribly often on a mass scale. And so naturally, development moves faster than the flood maps. Infrastructure improvements will, in some cases, improve the flood maps, meaning the flood elevation could actually go down from what they're predicting. And so those are situations where individual properties and individual buildings may actually qualify to be excluded, you know, from that current flood map.
I didn't think about that. So if it's just raw land and there's no canals or anything to channel the flow of the water, then yeah, maybe there's no change that's going to occur. But you're saying that you mentioned infrastructure. So I guess that's where things come into where you can kind of control the flow and everything. Is that how it works?
For every piece of construction that's done, right? It doesn't matter if it's a road or a building. There are plans to account where water will go, right? So any civil engineer on the project, they're always going to account for where should drainage go and runoff. And obviously those kinds of things, if there are water sources nearby, can change the flow of water that can ultimately impact a flood zone. So this is part of what the flood maps really exist for at the core, is permitting and safe construction habits to, you know, help to prevent, you know, like if you were to go and build something so that your construction doesn't automatically create a flooding hazard for all the neighboring properties. You know, so there are permitting and drainage requirements that help to prevent these kinds of things. You know, but naturally, if you take a piece of land and you're able to, let's say, bring in some soil and some fill, and you end up elevating your site, you know, for whatever reason, and if the topography at that point is then higher than the flood zone, there could be a chance that, you know, you could prove to FEMA that, well, now my property is built at a lesser risk than what the area flood map is now showing.
And what kind of elevation would you usually have to add to bring something out of a flood zone?
Well, you want to start. So when we talk about a land project with anyone, you know, there's a couple of data points that we, you know, first try to look for. Having a topography survey of the land so we understand the variations that exist currently. And then a flood zone analysis, right? So understanding the variation of how the flood zone may increase or decrease across the property, you know, because a flood elevation can change by a tenth of a foot, you know, within a very small area. And so understanding how we can compare the flood elevation with topography and what's the delta, right? Is it 2 feet or is it 6 inches? You know, it could be any number of variations. And so from a development standpoint, you know, what are you going to be able to do to potentially offset that? Because you're going to have to build your first floor of any building higher than the flood zone in any case. So in some cases, there may be, you know, situations where you can have dirt moved around the property or soil brought in that would then make up that difference to then bring the property, you know, up to that flood zone elevation. Ultimately reducing the risk and increasing the chances you could have FEMA rezone that area as an X zone, as opposed to like an AE 100-year zone.
Okay. Yeah, I actually just thought of that because I know that there's a lot of times detention ponds that are required. So I guess to retain that water and keep it there for managing all the flow of water. Mm-hmm. So I guess if there wasn't already a depression in the soil, you could maybe take dirt out of one corner of the property or whatever, and then put it in the other areas to bring the elevation up. Huh?
Yeah, lots of creative things that can be done. A lot of those detention ponds are by design on most properties because they've either moved dirt around and they needed to, again, account for where runoff water would go. And so a lot of times those ponds, though very beautiful, really have at the core a different purpose.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's interesting how usually you can kind of layer it in and incorporate it into the overall design and make it look like it's intentional. It's supposed to be there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so how does your company come into this? I think you hit on it a second ago about you can hire a consultant and everything, but what's the process of working with y'all and like, how do y'all help resolve these flood zone issues?
Yeah. So just to tell you a little bit more about us, right? So we're an engineering company at the core. We've combined quite a few different knowledge bases into one, flood zone engineering being, you know, the first, understanding and expertise in flood insurance itself being the second, but then also the real estate understanding. And so this way it allows us to think like an investor, think like an engineer, think like an insurance broker, you know, to be able to solve a lot of problems all within one property review. So we're looking at hundreds of properties every month all over the country, primarily existing buildings, you know, but we're taking them through a flowchart of different avenues to try to find some solution that will help either reduce the current flood insurance or eliminate the requirement from the lender entirely. And so going through a number of different channels, we're looking at elevation topography data of the site. We're looking at the declarations pages of the current flood insurance, and then doing a flood zone analysis, and then going through all this data and saying, all right, what different solutions are possible here? And it's about a 50% hit rate across, you know, our average in 2023 and lifetime of solutions that we find.
And is that, again, just because the maps haven't been updated for 10 or 15 years and it's simply requesting that FEMA update them, or how's that work?
Yeah, I mean, we're identifying individual buildings, you know, that have characteristics to where they can be excluded from the flood map. Again, you know, it could have been the way that it was built and the flood map perhaps wasn't updated, you know, particularly recent in that area. Could be a solution we find to help improve the rating of the flood policy itself. You know, so it's a combination of solutions, right? It's not only changing the flood zone because, you know, realistically, there's parts of the country where that's just not possible. But, you know, we do tons of work in Houston, right? A market you may think, well, that's a pretty flood prone area in general. But there's tons of variation of topography and there's, you know, tons of different properties that we find, you know, even current day still that can have their flood zone designation changed from like an AE to an X. But when that's not possible, that's when our team really digs into the flood insurance, looking at, you know, variables and scenarios that we can then go to the carrier and say, actually, we can improve the rating and here's the engineering to support that. So we do a lot of partnering with, you know, insurance brokers to help pass on those solutions to their clients.
Okay. And when you say rating, is that like, what do you mean exactly? Improve the rating?
Yeah. So on a flood insurance policy, especially if you're using the NFIP, National Flood Insurance Program through FEMA, they have a standard set of variables that they use to go in and essentially assess what they believe the risk to be of that property. And then they have multipliers, you know, for then getting to an end premium cost, you know, based on those variables. So if there's a particular variable that was perhaps being assumed or something or a combination of factors that can be, you know, shown to provide a better analysis for that building, then we can present those details to the carrier and then have a policy's cost then reduced.
Okay. And I guess that can be done at any point in the term of the policy.
That's what's unique about flood insurance, actually, you compared to other lines of insurance, is you can have the policies adjusted midterm. And in some cases, there will be refunds even issued back to the property owner midterm.
That's amazing. I had no idea. Huh. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, it seems like, I guess before a property was constructed, there was maybe it was a floodplain, and then after that, we kind of just to layer in everything we just discussed, all these different data points, like you might have new infrastructure, new buildings, everything else that impacted that and changed the flood zone. Am I understanding?
Yeah,
that
it's correctly? a lot of details that, you know, when you build something a certain way, it doesn't necessarily automatically have any impact on the flood zone or anything around it. And so it's taking those extra steps from our engineers to then take some of the current information, the changes, the analysis, to then be able to demonstrate that to FEMA. And, you know, they really depend on the private sector for that help because, you know, there's only so much funding to be able to go to a certain level of detail with these flood maps. And so they're having to create estimations across large areas at some point. In order to be able to say, okay, this area we deem to be a flood zone. And then, you know, from a land development standpoint, you're starting to get into tertiary markets, you know, outside of the urban areas, and you're running into flood zones in these, you know, lesser dense or lesser populated areas, flood zones that haven't necessarily had the flood study fully completed, you know, but yet you're trying to, you know, develop some type of property. And so that can create some difficulties, you know, for developers.
Yeah. Okay. Very interesting. And I guess I could probably look on the FEMA website, but what is it like, where do these letters come from? The AE and the X, like why those letters?
Well, you have the A category, the V category, which is coastal flood zones, you know, which is typically for like wave action and velocity of waves coming on shore. The A category flood zones, these are what you typically see around the majority of the country. AE being the most detailed, most common. Then you also see some other types of flood zones like AH, which typically indicates something to do with perhaps ponding in the area. And then there's a few other, you know, A category flood zones as well. They're all within the 100 year. And so they're all going to have the same insurance requirement that you'd see from the lender. And then you also see what's called an A flood zone. And if it's just an A flood zone, it means that the flood study wasn't necessarily completely finished to the point where there's been a flood elevation calculated for that area. And that's what I was mentioning before. Those are what you're running into a lot of times in the, you know, lesser, more rural areas around the country. And it's just that funding wasn't really committed to fully finishing out the flood study because there's no one at that current time, you know, really doing anything with that land.
So who would be funding it? Just the county?
Correct.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it wouldn't count on their funding. You know, unless you want to pay higher taxes, right? It all depends probably on each county.
I mean, it's budgets, right? So certain parts of the country, they allocate more funding to, you know, the updating and management of their flood maps based on, you know, the saturation of flood zones within that county. And, you know, so certain parts of the country, their flood maps update maybe every 10 years. We've seen certain parts of the country, it's only every 20. You know, so it's not right, wrong. It's just, lots of things to be managed, you know, not just the flood maps.
Okay. And so when I would be working with your company for a project, how long would it take and how much would it cost to do all this?
Yeah, the timeframes can vary, you know, by type of project, right? But if we're looking at a standard existing building, if it's a flood zone project, a lot of times these are completed within 6 weeks or less. Could extend a little further if there are some, you know, unforeseen complexities. In some cases, even less than 30 days, which I think a lot of people find surprising. But when you're looking at perhaps more development type projects, there's a variation of scenarios realistically. Sometimes you can still have FEMA approve the project, you know, within a preliminary period using some of the approved site planning. And, you know, if there's some mitigation work that's being done on the property during, you know, the site preparation. So you can get some conditional approvals, you know, still within, you know, 6 to 8 weeks in the early stages of the construction. Certain projects, you know, can extend further than that. But, you know, all in all, that works a lot of times within an acquisition timeframe, or, you know, if an investor comes to us and says, hey, we're looking at selling this property next quarter, and we're going to explore to see if there's any flood zone solutions to help add to the value before they sell it. So, yeah, I mean, the earlier you're brought into a scenario, the naturally the more time everyone has to go about the project in a more relaxed fashion.
Okay. And would approvals have to be obtained from county as well? Or are there any other local jurisdiction, or are they just obeying whatever FEMA hands down?
Most projects are done directly coordinating with FEMA. If there are instances where like a regulatory floodway is involved on the property, or if fill dirt was brought in, you know, during the construction of that property, then there is an extra layer of coordination with the local floodplain management. but realistically doesn't affect the timelines too terribly in most parts of the country. You know, so bring in the standard review is going to be, you know, really inside of a week from our team. And then if all solutions are possible, we can go straight into the production period with FEMA. About a third of our cases will have data missing. And there's additional details that are needed from the actual property itself to help, you know, enhance and maximize the possible solution for that property. So we have a field team on house that we deploy all over the country. And, you know, so we're going out collecting, you know, lots and lots of additional data at the buildings, at the property. And then our engineers are doing that full review process then, you know, kind of from square one with the fresh data. And, you know, in most cases, you know, we're pretty transparent with the clients to exactly what we think the percentage outcome will be. And, you know, we're about 70% successful right now with the site work producing the proposed solution.
Okay, very nice. And you mentioned the term a second ago, but I want to hear from you. Can you just describe the difference between like a floodway and flood zone?
Sure. Yeah, so regulatory floodway, these are areas that are deemed by the Army Corps engineers. A lot of times they'll come in, you know, more recently than when a flood map was put in place for that area. These are areas that, from a development standpoint, they've said that they want to try and maintain the current topography as much as possible, not to do anything that would negatively impact the flood zones. So floodways can be particularly difficult to develop in. A lot of people will avoid them for that reason, because construction can be nearly impossible given some of the requirements in place. So if a floodway has come into a property after construction, which does happen in some cases, in some scenarios, you can still have the particular buildings taken out of the flood zone to be categorized as a zone X. It's not as common, but can happen. If you're buying land, particularly, this is probably where you're going to run into this. So it's good to ask a lot of questions during the buying process so that this detail doesn't get overlooked.
Okay. But does it mean that like a floodway is going to flood every time it rains, or does that have anything to do with like the frequency of the flooding?
Not necessarily. They're typically deemed, you know, I would say higher risk areas compared to a standard flood zone. But it is an area where they have, you know, specifically designed for water to go in the event of, you know, some type of flooding. So that's why construction is difficult, because they don't want to do anything that would then impact the flood elevation or impact the flow of water within those areas.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes a lot more sense. I guess one other interesting like case study question I have, I'm working on a subdivision that was basically like a failed subdivision in Arizona. And the developer filed bankruptcy around the 08-09 period. And a lot of people are just kind of left holding the bag with these lots. And I'm thinking maybe I can just buy them and sell them. But what I find interesting is there's like hundreds of these lots, and they're all within a 100-year flood zone. So I'm wondering what the thinking was behind the developer at that time. Maybe they just thought they could remove it once they started construction, or what do you think about that? Like, why would anyone
honestly
do that?
Honestly, it probably was a complete oversight. There's not a lot of pre-thought that goes in with trying to have a flood zone changed, you know, for most development projects. If the civil on the job is familiar, they may add that on as part of the project, but we see it get overlooked in a lot of cases. So in 08, you know, they may have done some site preparation work. They may have been fine with being able to build within the permitting guidelines that they had. I'm not sure specifically for Arizona, but most states, the flood board rule is that the first floor has to be 2 feet over the flood zone elevation. So yeah, it'd be an interesting case to review and see, you know, what could be done, because it's going to make those houses, you know, more sellable, more attractive when there's not a flood insurance requirement put in place. With the changes that's happened within FEMA's insurance program, in some instances, flood insurance can be several thousand a year, even for a single family home.
Is that going to be like places in Florida, or where would that be common?
Everywhere.
Huh.
So okay. It's not just Florida that you run into these scenarios. Like anywhere there's a flood zone, there's going to be a flood insurance requirement to follow. And with the rollout of Risk Rating 2.0, which is FEMA's new insurance program rating system, new policies, like, for example, if an area wasn't in a flood zone before, but the flood map changes and now has brought in some new properties, those properties will start at FEMA's highest price point from day one. And, you know, we've seen cases already around Louisiana and other states where that can be quite expensive. And it can be disruptive, you know, to the acquisition of that piece of real estate.
Yeah, I bet. It definitely would not be fun to have to deal with. Huh. Okay. Just rounding out the questions, we maybe have already answered this indirectly, but what are some different strategies when it comes to like looking for acquisitions and like underwriting deals when you're trying to like look at acquiring properties in flood zones? Like, I guess strategies that your clients implement.
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, asking a lot of questions in the beginning is where it starts, and collecting as much information as possible. And what I mean by that is, if I'm going to buy a property from a seller and I know the property's in a flood zone, well, let me even back up. The first thing I should do is check if it's in a flood zone. You know, you can't expect that the other parties involved will necessarily find this. Some insurance brokers are very savvy, and then sometimes it can get overlooked. Same with real estate brokers. The one person who won't miss it is the lender. Whenever you get to that final stage and the lender is running their flood zone determination forms from whatever third party they use. So a strategy that we often encourage is in the very, very early stages is just pull up the property address on the FEMA map to see if the 100-year touches any of the buildings, right? You don't have to be an engineer to be able to tell that. And if that's the case, then start asking the seller for copies of their flood insurance declaration pages. Ask them if they have any elevation certificates or topography for their property. You know, some of that basic information can really allow someone like us to then be able to do a full review and figure out what solutions are possible. Because flood insurance is one of the only insurances that you can assume as a buyer from the seller. There's exclusions there, of course, but you know that makes it to where if the seller has a grandfathered pricing from the old FEMA rating system, you can adopt that pricing, and then that's going to help create a lot more cost savings in the years to come, as opposed to if you just purchased a brand new flood policy. That's generalizing. It's not every case, but pretty common, you know, use case that we really try to coach our clients to be aware of.
Okay. Yeah, that's an interesting point, because I have heard that, you know, with rising interest rates, if it's like some bridge financing, like say maybe they executed on their plan, they increase NOI on the property, and sometimes they can't service the debt. But then say they still can service the debt, they still might not be able to afford the new insurance policy because costs have been going up so much. Maybe not necessarily for flood insurance, but have y'all been seeing a rapid increase as well recently in flood insurance policy costs?
Yeah, so if a property is not at their full risk premium, which is FEMA's ceiling price, and you can see that if you look into the premium box on the declaration page. And so if a property is paying $2,000 today, but FEMA thinks that their full risk premium should be $4,000 for that building is going to see an 18% increase every year until they reach the full risk. So it's not as dramatic of a jump as that the property market has seen. But again, you know, 18% across 10, 20 buildings on a multifamily can add up quickly. especially when you know that that's going to come every year. So, you know, again, there's solutions to where if the requirement can be removed, that operator may choose to go without flood insurance if they're happy with that particular level of risk. In some other cases, there's ways to lower that full risk premium amount to where the increases that a property may see in the years to come could be less. But, you know, again, if a property were to go to the private market, perhaps there, maybe there's an appetizing price their broker was able to find for them, you know, a private market flood product. If that were to ever be non-renewed and they have to come back to the NFIP, they would start day one at the full risk premium. And so these are all factors that when we review a property, we're, you know, discussing with the client very objectively, just to paint a scenario and just so you can educate someone on what the, you know, potential scenarios could be down the road. Because not, it's not always that a solution exists. And so helping to coach, you know, details that we see every day that maybe somebody's broker or the operator hasn't seen before, so they can try to anticipate some of these scenarios so that, you know, any costly mistakes can be avoided.
Okay. Yeah, this is definitely very interesting stuff. Yeah, I think that we've hit on most everything. Is there anything else that you wanted to discuss before we go?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's important to understand that not all loan programs have the same insurance requirements for flood. You know, so if someone is coming off of bridge debt and they'll be switching into an agency program like Fannie or Freddie, it is highly likely that the flood insurance coverage limits will be higher than what they had, you know, maybe during their short-term, you know, type debt. So those programs will typically want full replacement value for the buildings. They'll add things such as business income. So if someone is looking to go into a refinance scenario, which, you know, there's quite a few properties that have that debt from 2020 maturing here soon, know going in that you're going to want to maybe have a group take a look at this scenario, have a look at the flood zone, you know, in anticipation before you start going through, you know, the debt restructure process. Because if there are solutions that exist specifically for the flood zone, it will then negate and remove those Fannie and Freddie requirements that you would have seen otherwise. So I think that's a big tip. We already touched on, you know, being able to assume policies. You know, I expect there's going to be a lot more transactions next year than there was in 2023. And then, you know, the third point is, you know, try to add the flood zone as a checkbox, you know, during your early underwriting and due diligence processes. It's not all doom and gloom. There's a lot of hidden NOI in the flood zones, as I always say. And so if it's something you're thinking about, you're going to notice it, may keep you from walking away from a deal in the future.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, I actually just remembered one last question on assuming an existing policy. Is that, like, how long are these policies typically? Are they typically your policy?
Annual.
Okay. So I guess I'm just trying to understand, like, the benefit of it. Because obviously, if you can assume some, like, a fixed rate loan that still has a couple years of life on it, then that's, that can make, like, your entire deal. But for an annual insurance policy, it's helpful, obviously, but not quite as helpful in the overall, like, 5-year hold period, for example.
So the scenario where it would be detrimental is if, like, you know, let's just use a single building type scenario. If someone's paying $2,000 for their flood policy and the full risk premium for that building is actually, say, $10,000. And instead of assuming the $2,000 policy, the buyer goes out, gets a brand new NFIP policy, and they will start day one paying $10,000. You know, so that's five times what they could have taken advantage of if they'd been able to assume the flood policy. You could imagine, obviously, if there's multiple buildings across, like, a self-storage or a multi-warehouse, multi-family, any type of situation like that where that would be multiplied, that impact can be, you know, pretty catastrophic. And then they are stuck at that particular price point for all the years to come. Even though the increase would be less, they may only see maybe a 5 or, you know, maybe 10% increase year over year. But they could have started at 2000 and only seen an 18% increase, you know, each year thereafter.
Oh yeah, that's true. I forgot about the 18% increase. That's like a statutory codified thing.
That cap, you could yeah.
The cap, yeah. Kind of like you have like your homestead exemption on your home. You can only increase the property taxes so much, all that, right?
Similar, yes.
Okay. Wow, that's actually very interesting, very helpful. Great. Well, if our listeners wanted to get in touch with you and kind of incorporate y'all into their team, how do they do that?
Yeah, they can send in any inquiry at info@nationalfloodexperts.com. info@nationalfloodexperts.com. They can go to the website. We have a submission form. They can go in and, you know, submit their information for a property to be reviewed. One of our team will follow up generally within 24 hours. They can also find me on LinkedIn. And always happy to connect with, you know, other investors and see what problems that we can help solve.
All right. Excellent. Well, this has definitely been my first time to speak with an expert in flood zone. So I appreciate you coming on. I think this was very interesting and helpful.
Excellent. Yeah. Thanks for having me on. Great conversation.
Hey guys, I appreciate you taking the time to listen or watch this episode. As you might've noticed, we don't run ads. But what I would like you to do is just subscribe to our YouTube channel. That would help us out tremendously. You don't even have to leave a review. But if you do feel like you had gained a lot of value from this episode, feel free to share it with your friends and comment, like, subscribe, all that. But subscribing to YouTube would be what helps us the most. That's the only thing I ask. Thanks a lot. And if you do want to get in touch with me, feel free to email me at mason@scalablerei.com. Thanks a lot.